and I think I had a bad microphone connection. I'm going to hope that the next lecture that I record doesn't have that hum in it. But the first ones were crystal clear. The last two or three had a lot of noise in them. Now, I did update and put a bunch of stuff on the website, so all of the lecture notes were up to date as of last Thursday. Audio was there for half of them, at least the ones that I had. And for some strange reason, and I think it may be that I may have a bad microphone, Simon Millikan's lecture on the high-speed line finding, I got nothing but noise the whole lecture. So, unfortunately, I have nothing for his. But don't worry, we'll have you implement it all for your midterm project. Anyway, Bill. Yes. And in fact, it turns out part of it was stolen from his PhD dissertation presentation. You know about those things, or will. You know, in a year or two or three or four. Just sometime in the distant future. Okay. Yes. It looked okay. You see, I was worried that it was too easy. That was a good response. Well, the second problem, if you stop and think about it, is really easy. Okay, some people don't agree with me. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah, don't use too much math. Just think about it. Anyway. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about camera calibration and finish it up a little bit, because where I left things the last time was I sort of set up the matrix but never really finished it or solved it. And reading-wise, it would be Shapiro, Chapter 13, Section 4. And what we're interested in is the following. Basically, our camera is, in effect, a black box. Does this kind of transformation, where we have focal length F. And we've usually got, and this I haven't said too much about, we've got a world coordinate system. And I usually use capitals, and most of the books use capitals. Question is, where should the origin of the world coordinate system be? Anywhere you want it. And in fact, one of the big things that comes up in calibration, and if you look at some of the pictures in Shapiro, what you'll see is a discussion of calibration jigs. A jig is nothing more than something that has a number of precisely machined or precisely positioned or whatever points. Simply, you know the coordinates of each of them relative to each other. And for example, one of the jigs that's shown in Shapiro is you have a block with very precisely machined holes, and we have pins which can be dropped into each of the holes, and the pins will have a ball at the end. And so I can put in all kinds of combinations, different heights, and I can produce a number of calibration points whose X, Y, Z, all capital, coordinates are known. So the point is, I might decide to pick that point right there as my world coordinate origin. Now, one of the ones that's shown in Shapiro can actually rotate. I'm not quite sure why I would build one that rotates. Usually there's a lot of error in things that rotate unless it's very precise. Other things which can be used, what we used to use when I was doing this stuff was we actually built a plate which had an array of optical fibers in it. Basically, this is a plate, very fine holes. We had an optical fiber in each, so basically each hole becomes a light emitter. And then this was on a precision translational stage. And if you're really trying to calibrate a 3D vision system, really trying to calibrate it, you know, to an accuracy of 1/10 of the field of view, or 0.1% of the field of view, that's very tight. And you need to do things like this. On the other hand, if what you're concerned about is maybe the terrain in front of Dexter, the mobile robot, and you might only want a foot, you don't need to go through such precise calibration. But these days, with laser interferometers, you can buy these now for $700. They'll measure distances, I think it's to 0.06 of an inch at out to 600 feet. You could make a calibrate a football field. And by the way, that is indeed how they calibrate football fields for the sports vision system. They use the little laser systems and poles and do it very, very quickly. But you can have all kinds of cleverness into coming up with a system that you put objects at points in your space, at known points in your space. There has to be a mechanism by which they are distinct and recognizable. For example, the balls, we can paint them or do something. They're round. You could find that with an image processing algorithm. Bright spots of light against the dark background, they'll show up. There are other similar techniques. One of the ones which Shapiro talks about is if you have an object with a lot of corners, one of the things that's often done is if you really want to find, let's suppose we're looking at an object head on, and this is our camera maybe looking that way, and let's suppose maybe you wanted to find the locations of the corners for calibration purposes. I'll make a comment. How would you go about finding, or actually I'll ask you a question. How might you go about finding the corners? What would be your technique? Yes. You're putting your hand, no, you're just scratching. Okay. Come on, anyone want to try? How would you really accurately find the location of the corners? Okay. I'll ask myself an answer. Okay, how would you do it? Do an edge operator, find the lines, and the most accurate way is fit an equation to each line and intersect. And in effect, what you've done is since you've averaged the edge, or you've averaged it over however many points that you've measured, you can get a very good statistically accurate measurement. By the way, this will be important later on as we're going to be talking about interest operators and how do you find things which are interesting in an image. Bugs think that way. Dexter's probably going to think that way. And it turns out there's a lot of interest lately in interest operators. No pun. Okay. So, calibration. World coordinate. Pick one which suits your calibration jig. Pick one which suits what you're going to be using your system for. Now, I'm only talking about mono. That is a single camera system. We could have two cameras. You'd simply use the same objects and look at them with two different cameras. The procedure would not change at all. The one difference would be if you're using an active laser range-finding system where instead of having a second camera here, what I might have is a laser pointer. Okay, that's different Because what you usually have to do, and it's almost like a control problem, you have to tell this system, using the picked up image from one of the cameras, to target it right, target the laser beam right on an object or calibration point. So it's a little more interactive if you have a pointer. Anyway, just wanted to mention that because you might get the hint that maybe the next work, next homework might have something to do with calibration. Okay, it will. Now, actually, I over-erased. The whole concept is really pretty simple. If we've got our coordinate system out here, and I've got a point in it, P, vector, in the world coordinate system, and I usually designate that, and I'm going to use the subscript here to represent calibration points. I'm going to try and be more organized than I was in the warping lecture where I started to get two K's in there. It just got confusing. So J indicates point J. I, E, P, world coordinate, J. Okay. We went through the affine transformations the last time. We talked about rotations, we talked about scale, we talked about translation, etc. What we're going to have here. And you, this shouldn't make a major problem for you, but you have to think whether you're going to follow what the image processing people do, which is the coordinate system in the upper left hand, or what the computer vision people do, which is put the coordinate system more in the lower left hand. The computer vision people here are more like robotics people than like image processing people. You can do it either way, but we're going to end up with corresponding coordinate. We'll have a P out here in the camera coordinate system. It's J, and those are the corresponding points. And this would be in coordinates UJ, VJ, 1. And lots of times I'm actually going to put the scale in here, and in fact, for this particular thing, I want to put the S in. We might have a scale factor because this might be in feet, inches, or whatever. This is going to be in pixels. So we have to have some kind of unit conversion. And for sake of solving this equation, we'll keep the S in for the moment. Now, what we did the last time is we can now write a general camera affine transformation. And by the way, lots of times we won't even call it an affine. We'll just call it the camera transformation. And it's going to do the transformation from my camera coordinate point, actually from my world coordinate point to my camera coordinate point. And this is just the matrix that I wrote the last time, which includes the rotation, the translation, the scale, the magnification. And so this accounts for all of those possible geometric parameters, but in 3D. 3D out here in the world, 2D over here. So it's a 3D to 2D transformation. And and we put a 1 in there for that last coordinate, because this would end up corresponding to the overall magnification. And if we let scale for or be accommodated for the exit for the U and the V axis in here with the C11 and the C22, there's no reason to have it other than 1. You know, you're just creating an additional variable that you didn't really need. Okay, and this will then be our XJ, YJ, ZJ, 1. And I think you can guess what we're going to do. Camera calibration consists of taking my jig, like I just talked about earlier. I take number of points in the world, look at the corresponding camera plane coordinates. And by the way, in terms of finding a camera plane coordinate, it is unlikely that your image will look exactly like that. First of all, our objects in the real world aren't square or even rectangular. They may not be that small. What you may have when you image going through the camera onto the image plane, now let's just something more like that. It can be, depending on what angle it's at, it could be converted into something that looks elliptical. There's all kinds of things that can happen. If you know that things like in that one jig I had here were round little balls, or like on the other jig, they were the ends of fiber optics, they're round, you could do things like fit an ellipse. You could fit a circle. One of the things that's often done is, this is a pretty well-defined object, and you simply come up with the pixels which you think belong to the object and find the centroid of this, the average position. And that's what you might use instead for your calibration position. But you see, we haven't talked about exactly doing all of this. Other things which you can do, maybe you fit a Gaussian curve to it. But chances are you will be doing some kind of processing here, and if you're averaging it over a number of pixels, you'll get better results. So you may not want to have tiny calibration objects. You may want to have reasonably sized ones for calibration. Okay? So, the situation is we've got a jig, we've got a camera, we don't move it while we're calibrating. In fact, we shouldn't move it, period, because we're calibrating relative to the coordinate system of the camera. And if I have, then, a selection of points out here in the world, selection of corresponding, then, image points, I can process them, find the center, and I've got these point pairs. Okay? Now, this doesn't work out as nicely as warping, because how many variables do I have? And that's going to end up, we have to do a statistical fit. Why? Well, we have to think about how we're going to set up the equations, just like we did for the warping. What are the unknowns? The C's, right? So what you can do is you can multiply this whole thing out. And I'm not going to do every term. And I think you sort of see this looks a lot like what we did before, but there's one little difference. We have a third equation. It's all is I multiplied this out. So each pair of points gave us this. This is not the form in which we want to set it up and solve it. Okay? And one of the reasons is that we actually have an equation here for S. We're going to put this in the first two equations. And so if you do something like S, C31xj plus C32yj plus C33zj plus 1, that's multiplied by the uj, C11xj plus C12yj plus C13zj plus C14 equals 0. Now what you do is exactly like we did for the warp. We rearrange the equation. What are the unknowns? All of the C. This equation doesn't have them all in it. So you'd have C11 I'm just so used to writing equals zero at the end. That was purely, I got carried away. Yes, there's no zero there. Okay, C31, C32, C33. There's no C34. And we'll have that equal to, and it turns out if you look at things, we have one term here which doesn't have a C in it. And for a given pair of points, that is, by that I mean world coordinates and image coordinates or camera coordinates, that's the one constant. So that's my one variable over on the right-hand side. Everything else is a coefficient of C, and what we need to do is go along and find, for example, all the coefficients of C11, which would be xj. What are all the coefficients of C12? Yj. The coefficients of C13? Zj. Coefficient of C14? 1. Do we have any coefficients in this equation of the C2s? No. Those are all zeros. And now we pick up the C3 ones, and notice what happens. I want to be careful. They're on the other side of the equation. I need to bring them over. I'll pick up a minus sign, and so you get something like minus xj uj minus, yj and minus, zj, uj. And I just set up the equation, this first equation right here, the one on the top, when I multiplied the the first row by the column vector, got that. Now you can do the second equation, and it'll come out in exactly the same form. It'll come out, so 0, 0, 0, 0. It will all be in terms of C2s. So it'll come out xj, yj, zj, 1, and it'll come out with slightly different terms here because you've got a V. And then this over here is VJ. I've just set up a matrix equation. So every time I get my matching set of coordinates, corresponds to my first calibration point, I've just generated two equations. And since I have 11 unknowns, I have to have greater than or equal to 11 equations. Since I get two equations per point, that is per calibration point, I need at least 6 points. And it is over constraint, meaning I would have 12 equations to determine 11 variables, and what would you have to do? Exactly what we talked about the last time. You have to use a pseudo-inverse or something similar. It's not square. That's the key thing. Anytime we end up with more equations than unknowns, we have an over-constraint. We've got to do it at least square stit. Okay? Now, one last thing. And Shapiro does a very, very nice job of explaining all of this with a lot more math than I have here. But there is one last thing, and that is, how do you determine how good your system is? Okay? Well, just like anything else, once we find C, okay, what we want to do is we want to compute. Normally you would think errors, but we call these residuals. And the idea is we solve for a set of C's, okay, and, oh shoot, why did I erase my matrix? Okay. Basically, we want to find the vector, which is the difference between P, C, J. Okay, these are the original calibration points. And now, I'll call this thing the matrix that I actually erased. Okay, the one that was here, which was my 4 by 3, C11, etc. I'll call that my C, and I want to transform then the corresponding world point, and technically that would be a transformation from W to C. If you want to use Shapiro's notation, that's Craig's notation, but that's fine, just like that. So you see, the idea is we use the points, we calibrate it. Actually, all we did was we solved the equation to get a set of C's. Since it's statistical, that means there are going to be errors. You know, it's not going to go through every point exactly. So we'd like to just see how good it is. And so you measure the errors. R is just the error vector, and usually what we actually do is we'll compute the magnitude of the error. You know, it'll actually be, we'll compute the square root of R, let's see, I guess xj squared plus ryj squared plus rzj squared. We might do something like that. Because all we're usually interested in is the magnitude. But if you're a really good engineer or scientist, what you might do is you might look at the vectors, plot them, and just make sure that there's no systematic error. You know, if you would, if this would be your actual, let's say this is your camera plane, where your image sensor is, and here is where you expected the points to be. And if they come out looking, you know, if you do this transformation and you get stuff like that, that's actually probably pretty reasonable. You see they're all over the place. But if we see something like more like this, I I would call that a systematic error, and it would be worth checking your math or checking your measurement or something, because it seems like you should have moved those all on top of those points and had a smaller error. So if you see something systematic, it indicates that that's worth looking at some more. Okay? And I haven't looked closely at the data, but I might give you a systematic error in the data. Now, one last thing is, if you can calibrate one camera, you can calibrate two cameras. All that would happen is that you would have maybe a C left-hand camera and a C right-hand camera. Now, what would be the idea of having two cameras? Stereo. Here's the other camera. We look at our point. We get an image. The following occurs. If I can somehow come up with those C's, let's say this is defined or characterized by the left hand and C right hand camera matrices, consider the following. I might just have out here a round, bright red object. You know, maybe we're supposed to catch the red rubber ball or something. I don't know. But for some reason, we're looking for a single object, and we're not getting into any fancy image processing. It's easy to recognize. That would be imaged into the left. That would be imaged into the right. Normally, given these two, what I could do is only project back a line from the left-hand camera, a line from the right-hand camera, okay, and I mentioned this previously, I find their intersection point in three-dimensional space, okay? Well, due to errors in calculating the C, due to measurement errors, due possibly to systematic errors, those will never intersect. They'll come close. And what standard approach in computer vision is, basically we crawl along one of the rays, we look for simply what's the closest point on the other ray, take that, compute the midpoint, and say, okay, that's actually where they intersect. And that gives us now the 3D world coordinates. 3D gives us the X, the Y, and the Z of the point that created that image on both cameras. Now, it's much easier said than done. Okay? And we would give you very carefully controlled, contrived data that wouldn't be too bad. So, any questions on camera calibration, stereo imaging, or anything like that? Because if you don't ask me a question, I'm going to start a brand new subject.
How difficult is it to keep them in calibration, stereo images, say for Dexter, we run it off road?
Well, what you would want to do with Dexter is you would probably want to, and admittedly Dexter doesn't look quite like this, but what you would probably want to do when calibrating is use some part of Dexter as your origin for your world coordinate system, and really what you're interested in is positions really relative to Dexter. The problem is, remember, your GPS stuff is coming in absolute. But for purposes of driving, I want to know that there's a trash can over there, a door over there. You know, I'm concerned with what's around me, and the further away it is from me, the less interesting it is. At least for the most part. You know, if I see the Carnegie Mellon vehicle coming up right behind me and it's going to run me off the road, I'm real worried. Or, you know, the Stanford vehicle rams you in the side. By accident, of course. But, you know, let's face it, all of these robots are out there running around. Well, you'll have to talk to these people that have read the rules in more detail. I don't think we actually have stop signs in the Cleveland street legal sense. Whatever Cleveland street legal is, I think anything goes on Cleveland streets. As long as a photo camera or a cop doesn't see you. Did you read last night about the photo camera that went berserk? Did it? It took pictures of every single, every vehicle. Well, actually, they said it didn't take any pictures. It's just that the flash circuit went out of control. I think so. Well, a little EMP pulse would take care of everything, wouldn't it? But we won't get into that. Modern Marvels just had an excellent little thing on, I guess, what would they call them? Beam weapons? Ray weapons? Directed energy. Yes. And it's funny. Did you see it? Did you see that 747 flying around with the little laser? Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I still remember that when I graduated with my PhD, that's the project they wanted me to work on out at the weapons lab. Except that was in a 727. We started a little smaller. Now you have a 747. And actually, the one plane they wanted me to work on is now in the Air Force Museum down at Wright Pat. Oh, I'm getting old. But anyway, okay, that was actually a good question about relative coordinate systems. So I would define my coordinate system with respect to some point on Dexter. I don't know where the most opportune point would be. And if you need to do anything else, you know, if you image something far away or something, you can come up with a coordinate transformation given that you know your GPS coordinates. You know, if you know your position on the map, you can put in absolute coordinates. For the purposes of traveling the roads, you know, following the map is important. But for the purposes of driving, I think it's primarily a local coordinate system. Does that make sense to everyone? You know, like you usually don't say, okay, latitude and longitude of that white stripe that I'm supposed to stop at, geographical location of the stop sign is. You know, usually you look for a red sign, or in our case, I guess we have to look for a white stripe. You recognize it, you have to apply the brakes and then stop relative to the stripe. And you can define that in Dexter's coordinate system for the purposes of controlling the brakes and driving. Okay. Now, I brought a prop for today's lecture, the rest of it, so you can get a hint of what we might be going to talk about. That is what's affectionately known in the trade as a color cube. By the way, it's somewhere on the website. You can actually, it's got the URL, and you can go find a website that's got this, and you can print it out and cut it up, you know, if you want to do this kind of thing. But we'll talk about it. This is a RGB color cube, and it handles a very large number of colors in RGB coordinates. And as soon as I get the vision, system here up, we'll start talking about color. An absolutely fascinating area. As Branicky was looking at my lecture notes today, I pointed out to him that there actually is still a lot of research going on in color. People don't really understand how to even do such simple things as color edges. into our textbook for a while. You know, you were wondering why you bought it. It really is a good book. In image processing, it still is regarded basically as the best book out there. Although the Shapiro book is very good for computer vision. Okay. 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 As we start, you're going to actually see a lot of references to General Electric. If there's anyone that understands color and lighting, it probably is General Electric. And in fact, I'll even point out the different kinds of light bulbs and stuff as we're going to go through some of the first slides here. I mean, do you understand what the difference is between a cool bulb, a warm bulb, and daylight? I see a couple yeses, but I bet most of you never paid any attention and probably don't care. Okay. Anyway, this is the classic. This is showing white light. We're going to talk about what white light is in a moment. White light is actually the combination of all colors, but what we'll see later is we'll typically think of it as like a combination of red, green, blue as we start talking about color spaces. This shows a prism, and it just shows that we're going to split it up into our red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, and not too much else I want to say there. Okay, the electromagnetic spectrum, that's pretty much what we just saw. Now, for the purposes of image processing, we usually tend to think that we're limited in here to the stuff that humans can see, but I'm going to show you some slides in this chapter that are going to incorporate things like microwave, radar, or infrared as part of it, and we're going to make pseudo-color images. Okay? Now, there are two sides of this. We're not going to get into it, but there is radiance. And if you talk, believe it or not, there are optical engineers. The units that they work in are unbelievable. I mean, when was the last time you heard a person start talking about steradians and 3D solid angles? And what these people are actually going to do is they're going to talk about how many milliwatts or watts of radiant energy are in a solid angle or on a unit element of surface area. And it's really interesting stuff, but we're not really going to do it. Radiance simply means I've got a source and it's emitting, and we'll usually think of it as watts, and it might be watts per steradian. So it depends. We'll be looking at the angular distribution. As you know, from laser pointers to light bulbs, the distribution of energy is not the same for different things. And then we have irradiance, and the I means incoming. Basically, this is what's received by a detector, a receiving surface, your camera plane, and just to get you going, we might use units of lumens. When was the last time you ever used the unit lumen or even heard of it? And then we have all kinds of other units. There's candelas, all kinds of fun things. We are not going to do that, so don't panic. Okay? We are going to look, though, at how the eye works a little bit. And it turns out that these are the measured responses of the cones in the human eye. And I have to remember my numbers here. We have the most cones to sense red. 65% of the cones are sensitive to red. The green ones, okay, we have 33% of the cones sense green, and only 2% sense blue. Now, what is interesting is that those 2% are actually the most sensitive. Okay, I didn't really put it in terms of units of the individual sensitivity. It's highly peaked towards the blue. Okay. Now, there's a lot of things that happened here before people understood color sensitivity. Because the eye responds to these, and we tend to think of them as the red, the green, and the blue, and there are some official wavelengths. There's an official red, there's an official green, and there's an official blue, which were established, and I can't ever remember what CIE stands for. It basically is a French, actually it's an international organization. They set up the red, the green, and the blue wavelengths in 1931. That was before anyone measured these curves, so they don't quite match. Okay? So you'll find all of these little things like that. We just didn't have good measurements of the eye. These are known as primary colors. And one of the reasons is that we can create all kinds of other colors with them. Now, I want to do a little diversion here about colors, because there's the science of color and there's the psychology of color. And color perception, color difference, is very subjective. Okay? And this is from the biological viewpoint, Bill will be very interested in this. Adaptation is a very important term in color, because the color that I perceive something as depends on what I last perceived with that sensor. You'll see what I mean. What it is if you've looked at stuff and stared at it and it's sort of burned into your eye, you have an after image. And if you switch from one set of colors to another, they change. The previous one affects your perceived color for a period of time. And even if you walk outside and, you know, you're temporarily blinded or anything, or I have photochromic lenses on my glasses, you know, that's all adaptation. Okay? And I won't say anything about this. There are some other issues here. The type of surface, whether it's a mirror surface, whether it's a rough surface. By the way, standard for all people working in computer vision is we get a matte white paint. Okay? We don't usually like colored objects. If we're calibrating things, we want everything to be a nice, not flat. We like it a little rough, so that it will scatter reflected light in all directions uniformly. Now, here is an interesting exercise. This is called the Stroop effect. Anyone here ever see this before? Okay, you know what I'm going to do? Okay. And you notice that we have two columns over there, and in one column, we've got the green, the blue, the yellow. Notice the words are the same. The colors are different. Anyone want to try reading off, just reading this column. Just try it. Okay? Now, try it the same way. Instead of reading it, tell me what the color is as you go down. Okay? Not as easy, is it? And you see, there's a lot that's going on. It's not just color. We're recognizing shapes and words, and you actually get messed up as you try to go down that list. Okay? Don't worry. Dexter shouldn't be facing issues like this. Now, color differences. And you can obviously guess what I'm going to ask. Are those the same color? And since I'm asking you, your suspicious answer is, possibly. But notice that you've got the high contrast over there. You've got a very different contrast here, and you're a little unsure. And by the way, mine are really bright blue, so obviously these things aren't color calibrated and aren't reproducing colors accurately. If I could rip this off here and turn it around and show you, I would. But they wouldn't like me to do that. But now, all of a sudden, you're much more reassured that that's all the same color. What is important here is the absolute color that you perceive and the relative color that you perceive. Because the relative color is what gives rise to color edges in things. Okay? And a little bit about the adaptation phenomena. I don't know how well this is going to work in a projector mode. So we'll try it. Okay? Oh, the colors are horrible. Crummy projector. We need a calibrated projector. Anyway, stare at this image, and we're supposed to stare at it for 1 minute. I'll give you 30 seconds. Burn those colors into your eyeballs, which is basically what's going on. And let's see what the next image looks like. What do you see? You saw complementary colors, I hope, for a little bit. It really doesn't work as well when it's projected on a screen. Looks much better with something printed in front of you. But technically, what you saw there for just a moment or two was actually, I think it was the flag of South Africa. This is not the flag of South Africa. That one was. And this one is actually very effective. It sort of messed Branicky up a little bit. Stare at this little dot here. And then I'm going to show you some colors, and at least I can visually see the adaptation occurring. Ready? Now, see? You actually probably saw like an impulse response there to that set of colors. Okay. Now, here's one that doesn't affect me at all. And I think it's just because it's not narrow enough. The idea is, as blue lines get smaller, they're supposed to look green. I'm not sure I believe this for projection. This one didn't work on me at all. I think we need to get them much smaller. Yes? Yeah, you can't resolve, and that's where I don't think these are small enough. And in fact, combining colors. How perfect for you to lead into our next slide, because we're going to talk about colors. And these are standard color diagrams. We're going to talk about different kinds. And boy, this is really crummy coloring. Look at that. That's like a robin's egg blue. That's supposed to be a nice dark blue. Okay. Yeah, isn't this really messed up? I'm going to have to talk to it, but I bet that CWRU can't afford color calibration of monitors. But, by the way, this is a real problem if you are a local company like American Greetings, Sherwin-Williams, etc. One of the major issues, and I don't know, does anyone in here actually worry about calibrating monitors? Color calibration? Exactly. You get really worried because people spend all of their time at the computer screen. You photocompose something. It's exactly the way you want it. And then it prints out in completely different colors. And you're about ready to strangle someone. The moral is big companies that are involved in the print industry want what you see is what you get. And there's lots of software you can get out there for calibrating your colors. Okay. Now, these are the primary additive colors. Red, green, and blue. Yes, I know they're pretty washed out. But sort of along the lines of that prism that we had earlier, if I have white light, it will be composed of an equal mix of red, green, and blue, and in fact, that's shown by here at the center, because that is now in transmission. That's what it's supposed to be. We're really looking at a reflection here. But the idea is the combination of these three gives you the white in transmission. So if I had a red laser, a green laser, a blue laser, I'd end up with a white light laser beam. Or if I just took red and green, I'd get yellow. Or green and blue, I'd get cyan. Boy, that's the funniest looking cyan I've seen in a long time. But these colors add in transmission. Now, these are usually known as the secondary colors for the additive primary colors. All of that is in transmission. Now, we can do the very same thing, and this is now where a company like Sherwin-Williams gets really interested. And this is also, by the way, where your real problem in calibration comes in. Because when you look at a monitor, you're usually looking at an additive color. When you are looking at something that's been printed, it's reflecting, and it's actually a subtractive color. Okay? And so, if you've got, cyan, okay, something that reflects cyan absorbs all the red. So that's why they're diagonally opposite. Something that reflects yellow absorbs all the blue. So what you have to do is tailor the absorption characteristics of your pigments, your paints, your dyes, etc. And that, by the way, is exceptionally difficult because they're on top of each other. Paints tend to be a lot more opaque than adding three beams of light together. You know, you're not quite dealing with the same effect. But there are some very good color chemists at Sherwin-Williams. There's also some very good color people at American Greetings. And I'm sure there's other companies around town that get into this graphic arts color. The big thing is, this points out the distinction between white and black. White is the transmission of all colors. Black is the absence of all colors. Now, how many of you have ever tried to print maybe on your inkjet printer with no, and it doesn't have a black cartridge? You ever wonder why it has a black cartridge? If you've ever added cyan, magenta, and yellow together, you get a pretty ugly looking black. It doesn't absorb very well because you're going through three layers of ink. And it just doesn't absorb properly. You usually end up with a mud or a gray. Okay? And the best thing is you just simply print on top of where you want that black, a black which is designed to absorb all the colors. It's designed only for that function. It's not designed for any kind of accurate color reproduction at all. Now, this is always particularly the subtractive colors or the pigment colors. Combining them is at times as much an art as anything else. Now, we're going to be concerned about color characteristics. And there's three things that are usually used to define color. And by that, I mean if I'm looking at any image and I see a point and it's got a particular color, the first one is brightness. Because we can look at something and we can say, and this is not a good thing to look at, but if I look at an image, we can say, oh, that's light or that's dark. It could be the same color, but we'll say it's light or dark. That's the brightness. Now, the two things which are going to probably be very important to us, it'll get messed up. Oh, wow, it didn't. That's amazing. Okay, is U and saturation. Okay, now U is, you can sort of think of this as the wavelength if you want. Or you can think of it, some people call it the dominant color. But I like to just think of it as the wavelength. Specifically, red, green, blue, whatever. Cyan, magenta, yellow. This, a lot of people interchangeably use for color. What saturation is how much white do you have in it. Take a good, solid red. Start adding white to it. What do you get? Pink. Okay? That, the red is a nice saturated color. The pink is not a saturated color, but it might be the same red. So think about that. Okay? Now, we call these chromaticity. And if you want to compare a black and white image with a color image, the brightness would correspond to the black and white image. The chromaticity is all of the extra color information. Now, how many of you have ever seen this diagram before? How many of you actually know what this diagram means? Okay, well, this is a chromaticity diagram. It's actually displaying the U and the saturation information. But to explain that, and we'll just write a few things over here. We're going to talk about tri-stimulus values. Anyone ever hear of those? Bill, you must have. Okay, good. Yeah, usually if you prod Bill, he agrees. Okay, Basically, this is a way of specifying red, green, and blue. Okay. We're going to have X, Y, and Z, and there, the amount of red, green, and blue needed to make a color. Now, that's a pretty vague statement. Okay. Now, we come up with this in a coordinate system where x, little x, is going to be capital. Okay. Basically, a tri-stimulus value is an RGB. It's a triplet. Don't worry, that's just my phone. And all it is it's normalized to the total coordinates of the color space. That's all. And we would have little y and little z. And the interesting thing about this, which is important, is that little x plus little y plus little z equals 1. That's why we use this coordinate system. That's why we talk about tri-stimulus values. Okay? Because I have a chromaticity diagram here, and what I'm showing or plotting is red on the horizontal. This is the little red R, or X. The little green Y. Do I need to plot Z? No, because as soon as I specify X and Y, Z is known. Okay? Now, this is interesting because this basically gets into U, saturation, the colors that the human eye can see, and even things like white. It turns out, if you look at the coordinates very carefully, and this is 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, okay, the point of equal energy, where red equals green, equals blue, equals 0.33. If you take a look, that's about there. We come across, and we come up here, and that's known as daylight. And if this were a good color-calibrated system, you'd have something here that looks like daylight outside. Nice, bright, white, white. Okay? And as you move around in this space, what happens is, if this is the point of white, if I travel any line out, that is a line of constant U. If you want to, I sort of think of it as color in little letters. But if I travel out, you can see this sort of looks like green. This sort of looks like blue. This sort of looks like red. And by the way, you can see that this definitely is not equally sensitive. The eye perceives ranges of colors dramatically different. Red, green, and blue. Dramatically. Now, by the way, here are your General Electric light bulbs. If you get fluorescent lights, the cool white has more blue in it. It's closer to the blue. The warm white has more red in it. More gold. Okay, so that's actually the difference between the light bulbs. And I guess, I think those are the major things. Right here are fully saturated colors. What that means is there's no white in them at all. And as you go around, that's the total range of colors that a person can perceive. Now, we're going to rapidly run out of time, but this is what people who design monitors look at. This is what people who design printers look at. The R, the G, and the B points here are the red, the green, and the blue that your LCD monitor can produce. Or if you have that 60-inch plasma TV, the red, the green, and the blue that they produce. Different monitors, if you just turn it on, all green. Different monitors will produce different greens. And a CRT monitor, very different than an LCD, very different than a projector, very different than, let's see, what did I forget in there? Oh, there's a whole bunch of different kinds. Same thing for the red and the blue. If we are dealing with a monitor of any kind, that's generating light. Okay? So that's additive color. Because it's additive color, that means that I can produce any color that is inside that boundary formed by red, green, and blue. And people, when they work with CRTs, they made a really, really big research study of the different phosphors that they would put on the screen, and did really worry about how deep could they get the green, how could they position the red. So that determines the region of colors. Now, we've talked about what happens when you print stuff before and how difficult it is to print blacks and colors when you put pigments on top of each other, it doesn't work out well. Well, this might be a good color printer in here. You see, printers have a fundamental problem in achieving the saturation of transmitted colors. It's usually just not going to happen. Now, if you came up with a new printing process, people would be really interested. Hewlett-Packard, I'm sure Epson, everyone would want to talk to you. Okay? But coming up with good, you know, that's more organic chemistry. Actually, it's even worse than that. It's photochromic chemistry. Okay, now, unfortunately, we're just going to get to my fun thing as we run out of time. This is the basis of the color cube. And the way it works is, we talked about RGB. We could produce a lot of colors from RGB. Let's quantify it. We come up, and I'll only talk for a few moments, a red axis, a green axis, a blue axis. Just like the tri-stimulus values, we're going to normalize them to 1. The total absence of red, green, and blue gives you black. Sorry, this was printed, so, and it wasn't printed on the manufacturer's right paper, so it's not going to be perfect. Okay, but that's actually black down there. And the exact opposite is what happens if we have as much red, as much green, and as much blue as we can. That's up here. That is the point of maximum white. So we have black, we have white. And one little thing, which is interesting, is if you draw a line from 000 to 111, at every point along the line, there is an equal amount of red, green, and blue. So technically, it's white the whole way. Not quite. It's black down here. It's white up here. What you've just done is created the line of gray. So every possible gray. It's black with various amounts of white added to it. And we're going to start from there next time. Next time, we'll do real color image processing.